Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. From the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida, I'm Ron Elving.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, are you allowed to say FSU on the air?
I think that this is one of America's greatest educational institutions, and I think so even more having been here for the first time.
So, Ron, you're not in Washington, D.C. The big news was a story about Jim DeMint announcing he's going to resign from Congress, from the Senate.
And Jim DeMint is becoming the president of the Heritage Foundation. And the New York Times headline read, DeMint to step down from Senate. Does Jim DeMint think he's stepping down if he leaves the Senate to head up the Heritage Foundation? And in the Washington, D.C. of today, is it a step down to leave the Senate in the minority and take over as president of the largest conservative think tank in Washington?
Plus the fact that if you're leaving a Senate that most likely will work on a budget fiscal cliff compromise with President Obama, and most likely the Republicans will give up some of their cherished principles to make this compromise, that is something that Jim DeMint would probably not want to be a part of. And so maybe getting out while the getting as good is exactly what he should be doing.
Now, in the spirit of the podcast, It's All Politics, Fairness Doctrine, we would like to first let Senator DeMint tell us in his own words why he's leaving the Senate.
It was the Heritage Foundation that inspired me to run for Congress, and much of the policies, many of the policies that I've developed, whether it be Social Security reform or health care reform, tax reform, Heritage has guided that policy development. And I believe that I can do more good for the conservative movement outside of the Senate and leveraging the assets of the Heritage Foundation to communicate a more positive, optimistic message to the American people.
Of course, that was Jim DeMint speaking on the Rush Limbaugh show. But, you know, you wonder if what the reaction is or what the feeling is about Jim DeMint within the Senate. Of course, Democrats don't like him, and of course, you know, he doesn't like Democrats, and that's fine. And you know that outside conservatives love him. He's a true believer. He does not waver. He does not, I mean, you could even make the case he does not compromise. But if you're a Republican, and maybe if you're an establishment Republican, but whatever, if your goal is to get a majority in the Senate to back the Christine O'Donnells and the Richard Murdochs of the world, that may not be the way to win over the hearts of Republicans looking to get majority status.
All right. Now, is it fair to call Jim DeMint the spiritual leader of the Tea Party in the Senate or possibly even in the Congress as a whole?
I say absolutely. You know, he never was going to become in the leadership. He was never going to rival Mitch McConnell, even though Mitch McConnell always felt that he had to watch his back when it comes to Jim DeMint, because Jim DeMint would often take on the leadership of his own party. But having said that, he still has a strong core of supporters. He did back the Ted Cruz's and the Rand Paul's. And the
Also winners. And the losers, but also winners.
Right, and the Marco Rubio's and the Mike Lee's against establishment Republicans when other Republicans say, don't do that, they're too conservative to win. So, as I said, for all the Richard Murdochs and for all the Christine O'Donnells that he may have endorsed, he also backed some winners as well. But again, it was against his own party.
Do you think it's fair to say that even if the Tea Party was not going to be able to get the Republicans into the majority in the Senate, that Jim DeMint was the guy most in position to organize the votes they do have in the Senate, some of those winners that you just mentioned, into an effective force that would be able to either counter Mitch McConnell within the Republican caucus in the Senate or actually act as an effective counter-minority that even if Mitch McConnell wanted to reach some sort of accommodation with Harry Reid and the Democrats, they could prevent Mitch McConnell from doing that. In other words, a sort of effective third party in the Senate that could keep the Senate from doing anything.
And he has done that in the past. He has bottled up the Senate with filibusters and things like that. He has also threatened, in not so many words, you know, some moderate inclinations of Republicans already in the Senate. But he also knows that, speaking of the fiscal cliff, he also seems to know that a compromise is in the making. It may be today, it may be this week, it may be certainly by the end of the month. But either way, it's not going to look good for the true believers of the Republican Party. And perhaps Jim DeMint feels that he will be more effective outside the Senate than he would be inside.
Now, of course, technically, he's quitting at the end of this month, correct? So he's still around to vote against whatever the Senate may agree to before the 31st of December. And it's more the symbolic value of walking away at this point and essentially brushing the dust off as he leaves the Senate that he sees as being too much involved in compromise. Is there anybody else to take his place? Would Rand Paul move into that role, or is he more interested in running for president in 2016?
Well, that's a good question about Rand Paul, because for all the thoughts that he may be the new Ron Paul in the Senate, he did ultimately endorse Mitt Romney for president, unlike his father. We should also point out that for all the battles that Jim DeMint has had with Mitch McConnell, we should point out that Ron Paul's son-in-law and former campaign manager, Jesse Benton, is now the campaign manager for Mitch McConnell in 2014. So I kind of think that Rand Paul is making his peace with Mitch McConnell. He won't be the new Jim DeMint, if anybody will. I mean, there'll be a smaller Republican conference in the Senate, perhaps a lessening of Republican influence. But again, leaving the Senate may give Jim DeMint that extra power that he might not have had being in a further diminished minority.
Do we believe Jim DeMint has further political ambitions beyond the Heritage Foundation?
I think not. I mean, I haven't even thought about that. I mean, there were always some people who would say he would make a perfect president. Jim DeMint seems very satisfied to be behind the scenes and pulling the strings. Of course, let's point out that the decision to name a replacement for Jim DeMint rests in the hands of Governor Nikki Haley, a Republican who's not the most popular Republican in the world, but certainly she has a lot of power. And one of the Republicans named as a possible successor is Tim Scott, the freshman congressman from South Carolina, one of two African-American Republicans in the House, will be one after Alan West leaves after the end of this month. And Tim Scott, of course, would be only the second African-American Republican, if he's appointed, to the Senate since Reconstruction. You remember the first one?
Ed Brooke.
Ed Brooke, elected from Massachusetts, and he would be the first from the Deep South since Reconstruction. So there's a lot of symbolic opportunities for the Republicans should Tim Scott be the appointed senator.
Absolutely. That would be an interesting pick on the part of Governor Haley. Are there other people that are in the running, or would Tim Scott's choice to some degree indicate that there was not really all that much of a bench or a clear person standing in line behind DeMint?
Oh, there's a ton. There's a huge bench. Matter of fact, except for Jim Clyburn, every member of the congressional delegation from South Carolina is a Republican. And what's also interesting, too, is a lot of these Republicans were looking at a possible challenge to Lindsey Graham in the 2014 primary. And perhaps maybe they don't look at Lindsey Graham anymore. Maybe Lindsey Graham becomes less vulnerable and they look at that seat, which will come up for an election in 2014.
Okay, one more note, though, on Mitch McConnell before we leave Mitch. And he is having quite a high-profile week trying to get involved in these negotiations on the fiscal cliff between the president and John Boehner mainly, and he's sort of out there as the third wheel. He also has to worry about whether or not, even assuming he does get the Republican nomination in 2014, he might have his most significant Democratic opponent in some period of time. And he hasn't always had that easy a time getting reelected in an actress.
Yes, it's Helen Gahagan Douglas. No, actually, it's another actress. Well, she was an actress who did run for the Senate in 1950 and lost to that. What's his name?
I believe it was Richard Nixon.
It was indeed, yes. Well, Ashley Judd, who actually lives on a farm in Tennessee, but is an eighth-generation Kentuckian. Matter of fact, she is a big University of Kentucky fan, and Mitch McConnell's a University of Louisville fan, so that would be a good battle anyway, yes. But, I mean, Ashley Judd's a strong liberal in a state not known for electing liberal candidates. She's, very strong on pro-choice on abortion and equal rights and the environment. She's taken on the coal industry. She's very strong in support of President Obama in a state where Obama did not do well, shall we say. So I kind of think it's a nice liberal pipe dream, but I don't think it's doable or realistic, unless you do. Do you?
Is the question going to be whether or not I think Kentucky is looking for a liberal woman who likes Barack Obama to be their senator? Is that
no,
the question?
No, I think you're looking for a liberal woman just on principle. Yes, the liberals love her. She's a dream candidate for many liberals. But given the fact that this is Kentucky, given this is the fact that it's a state that President Obama did not do so well in a presidential year, and one would think that the Republicans will do better in the midterm elections, Ron Elving will Ashley Judd run for the Senate?
She might. I think that there is a sort of glam factor here that that maybe we haven't seen since Phyllis George. And, of course, Phyllis George and her husband were back in the 1970s,
right,
when I think that even Ken was paying attention. So I think that it's been a long time, and maybe Kentucky would like to have a little bit of that spice in their political life.
And do you know, this is a great trivia question that I wouldn't dare unload on you because I had to look this up myself, but the last Republican senator leader defeated for re-election was James Watson of Indiana in 1932. So So Mitch McConnell has that going for him, at least.
Well, he certainly does. The Watson precedent from 1932. All right.
Yeah.
Well, this strikes me as good a time as any to veer into substance here on the It's All Politics podcast.
And Ken, I hate that stuff.
Do we still care about the unemployment rate here on It's All Politics now that the election is over? Of course, we care about the American economy. We care about the unemployed. We care about unemployment benefits, which are still part of the fiscal cliff negotiation and therefore still a live political issue, even though the election itself is over. But hasn't a little bit of the suspense and the enormous interest in the monthly unemployment rate kind of gone down a little bit since November?
Yes, it has, and which is remarkable because the headlines of this week that the unemployment rate is down to 7.7% with a much larger job creation number than anybody expected. Not only is this remarkable, but this could hurt Mitt Romney's chances of carrying Ohio on the Fox News channel.
All right. And also having a little bit of good news on the economic front possibly is a small nudge in the president's direction as he tries to negotiate these higher taxes on the rich. He wants to see several percentage points added to the rate that's paid by people over $200,000 individual, $250,000 for a couple. And this seems to be gaining a certain amount of poll support. It was supported in the exit polls of people who voted on November 6th by about 60% of those who voted, did better than the president himself did. And this seems to be putting the Republicans in an uncomfortable position. They simply cannot support higher taxes on anybody, especially not higher tax rates, and still be able to turn around and talk to some elements of their party, as they've been reminded this week pretty constantly by many voices on the right.
Well, there are some, you know, Republicans who have not totally ruled out voting for higher taxes or at least higher rates and things like that. But as far as House members from the right challenging and disputing the leadership of John Boehner, there was an interesting article in the New York Times this week that said basically that the party is uniting behind him. Maybe that's one of the things that Jim DeMint is not happy about. But it seems like House members, and we had Jason Chaffetz of Utah on Talk of the Nation this week, who said the same thing. He said, look, we're all behind him. Whatever these negotiations are going to be, and we're not going to always get everything we want, but we are lockstep behind John Boehner. And that's certainly a different situation than it was for Boehner 2 years ago when there was almost outright rebellion.
I'm wondering, too, how much of a difference it makes to many of these Republican legislators, the ones who are still going to be able to vote on this fiscal cliff deal here in December, that so many people in the business community who are usually identified with the Republican Party, many of whom may have been donors to Republican campaigns in the 2012 elections, have been coming out in one way or another in support of some sort of compromise that may create more momentum in the president's direction. They may not support everything the president wants to do. They may not support much of what the president wants to do, but they are in support of a deal, and they assume that means some must be given to the president. And the president seems to be playing on this in his own dealings with the business community. Here he is speaking this week to the Business Roundtable.
There have been reports, and these are not necessarily confirmed, and maybe some of you have more insight than I do on this, that perhaps the Republicans go ahead and let the middle class tax cuts get extended, the upper income tax cuts go up. Otherwise, we don't get a deal. And next year, we come back, and the thinking is the Republicans will have more leverage because there will be another vote on the debt ceiling, and we will try to extract more concessions with a stronger hand on the debt ceiling. I have to just tell you, that is a bad strategy for America. It's a bad strategy for your businesses, and it is not a game that I will play.
I honestly don't know how the rest of the country is seeing this whole thing coming in Washington, because most likely for all the dire predictions and the consequences that could happen, I think most people feel that, yes, you know, Washington will posture and bluff and do everything they can to make political points, and at the end, a deal will be made and everything will be fine until the next crisis, which could be in 6 months. But I just wonder how it's playing around the country, because there's tickers and there's clocks about when the deal has to be signed by. And ultimately, I wonder if around the country it's a great big yawn that it will just, you know, here we go again, and it'll be all solved at 1 minute to midnight.
And that may be the optimistic way of looking at it, that it's a great big yawn, which would be a good thing, relatively speaking, because that would probably indicate that people are really not going to affect their own economic behavior one way or another. Then, of course, there could be the rude shock if we actually do go over the cliff, that is, if the deadlines pass and tax cuts expire and people suddenly find themselves making less money, taking home less money, I should say, and they suddenly hear about all of these draconian cuts coming to all kinds of federal spending programs. And, of course, the defense industry will go public with all of their cuts that they're suffering and this enormous amount of money that would be reduced from the Pentagon budget. So then we could get a quite horrific public reaction a little bit later, and that would obviously not be of benefit to any of the politicians involved. So the polls are something of an indicator, I think, that most people think there's going to be a deal, but most people admit they don't really know what effect it would have on them if there isn't. And also, as the political agent in these polls, there seems to be about a 53% majority who would primarily blame Republicans, 27% in the Pew Research Center poll saying they would primarily blame the president if there's not a deal, and then the rest of the people saying they blame both equally.
Before we leave Congress completely, the final election of the 2012 season happened Saturday in Louisiana. This is the third congressional district. Two Republicans are running against each other because of redistricting, Charles Boustany and Jeff Landry. Boustany has the seniority. He has the establishment backing. He has a better geographical hold of the district. Jeff Landry is backed by the Tea Party. But either way, a Republican will win. One Republican who will not be winning after this year is Joanne Emerson. She's a congresswoman from Missouri's 8th Congressional District. She announced that in February she will resign from Congress to become the president and CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Coincidentally, the group that has been bankrolling her campaigns more than any other group. But she's leaving Congress, and there will be a special election in that district. But that is also a solidly Republican district.
Fair to say that Joanne Emerson, who succeeded her late husband, who also served in that seat, was one of the more moderate elements in the Republican conference at this point, and certainly somebody who had relationships that could cross party aisles.
I'm not sure if I would call Joanne Emerson a moderate. She's very, very conservative, but perhaps compared to the newer class of Republicans, she's more in the middle, yes.
And a lot of this is a matter of style and attitude as opposed to actual ideology,
right,
or votes on positions on bills. And, you know, when you talk about the new crowd that's running the Republican show these days in the House, I'm reminded, too, of the people who took over the House back in the 1990s and a fellow who was a big part of that alongside Newt Gingrich. And that was Dick Armey, who was really the number two guy in the whole Gingrich revolution back in those days. He was the Aaron to Newt Gingrich's Moses, if you will. And Dick Armey has been recently associated with one of the main elements of the Tea Party, one of the pillars of the Tea Party movement, called Freedom Works, which he has just left this week. What is going on there?
Well, it sounds like it's a personal feud. It's apparently he's accusing the president of taking the group's resources and using it for his own personal account. But the point is, Dick Armey helped create Freedom Works. It was a big player in the Tea Party movement, and the group insists that they'll be fine without him, but it is a major loss, or at least a major name, leaving a very prominent organization. But, you know, Ron, when you mentioned 1994 and the Republican ascension to power, one thing I'd like to add, though, one Democratic name who left the scene after the 1994 election was Jack Brooks. He was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. It's pretty rare that a Judiciary Committee chairman gets beaten, but he was defeated by Steve Stockman in that year. And, you know, Jack Brooks was an amazing guy. He was in the motorcade when President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. He was on the Judiciary Committee during the impeachment of President Nixon. He also voted for civil rights bills when many members of Congress in the South refused to do so. Anyway, Jack Brooks died Tuesday at the age of 89. He was quite a character, one of those Democrats we haven't seen in a long, long time.
Ken, we usually end our podcast talking about people who have left us during the last week, but this week there's maybe something we want to tack on as a post-mortem. What do we make of the apparent effort that was made by some people at Fox News to interest David Petraeus in being a presidential candidate in 2012, when he was still at the time the commander in Afghanistan, before he took the CIA director job? Roger Ailes was interested in managing his campaign, resigning, of course, as the head of Fox News to do so. And Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox, was interested in bankrolling the this campaign, or do we believe any of this story?
Well, this is a story allegedly sent from Roger Ailes to an emissary while he was in Afghanistan. Now, there are a lot of Republicans, there are a lot of Americans who thought that David Petraeus would have made a great president, and perhaps they still feel he could make a great president. But what's disturbing to me, and I'm not saying this because we're NPR and we know what Roger Ailes says about NPR, but the fact is that this is the president of a news network who is urging a person to run for president and implying or insinuating the head of News Corp would bankroll the campaign. Is it true? We don't really know. But if somebody, the head of NBC or ABC, decided they wanted a Democrat or a Republican to run for president, I mean, that would really set into motion a lot of questions about news judgment.
I think the only question that you can raise, and no one has denied that these conversations went on, I think the question you can raise is whether or not this was ever taken seriously by Petraeus, whether it was taken seriously even by the emissary, the intermediary in this case, who was a Fox News contributor and author, whether or not this was the kind of thing that was done almost playfully or whether it was something that was really seriously being contemplated by the forces behind Fox News, Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I don't know if David Petraeus took what Roger Ailes said seriously, but I do know that Karl Rove and Dick Morris seem to be taking seriously what Roger Ailes seems to have dictated.
Yes, and we saw a little bit of this after the 2008 presidential season was over. Some people went from being political figures to being Fox News commentators and vice versa. I think this is a little bit of fallout about some of those predictions in the last days and hours and even on election night from these two individuals. Karl Rove, I think, had a rather embarrassing turn on air trying to deny that everybody else, including Fox News, calling Ohio was accurate. And then, of course, we had in the final days before the actual voting, Dick Morris guaranteeing a Romney landslide. That didn't look so good in retrospect. This is apparently there does exist a point at which there's a line that says too far.
Obviously, what we're talking about here is that Fox News employees have been told that if you intend to book Karl Rove or Dick Morris on the air, you have to get permission from top management. And perhaps one of the reasons for this is the fact that the election is over and we may not need them as much as we did prior to November 6th. But ostensibly, the reason you put Dick Morris on the air is because he'll give you some valuable insight. But I don't think Fox News got much valuable insight from Dick Morris, given how way off his predictions were.
Now, that arrangement at Fox for Morris and Rove, where you have to get special permission to actually put them on the air, that's pretty much the arrangement NPR has for you and me, isn't it, Ken?
Well, something, that sounds like it's the end of the podcast.
And that is it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
And from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida, I'm Ron Elving.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw. And by the way, speaking of Kathy Shaw, I don't know if you heard her new song that's out about her life story, How Can I Be Shaw?
In a world that's constantly changing, join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.